and welcome to New Books in Art. I am the host, Lorena Turner. I am a lecturer in the Communication Department at the California State Polytechnic University in Pomona, California. Today I spoke with Ken Light, a documentary photographer, on his new book, What's Going On, 1969 to 1974. His book is a selection of personal and professional work that he did as a photographer from the early 1970s when he was in college in Ohio. He talks with us about his work, as well as what drove him to want to work in photography and why he still prefers to shoot on film. I'm talking today to Ken Light, the author of the new book, What's Going On, 1969 to 1974. Ken is a freelance documentary photographer and teaches at the Graduate School in Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? What's your education? How did you get interested in photography?
So I was born in the Bronx, and when I was very young, 3 years old, my parents moved out to Long Island, which would have been 1954. And I grew up in the new suburbia. So the town I lived in was right next to Levittown, which was the first, I want to say, not manufactured, but the first developed suburbia in America after World War II, when the men came home from the war. My dad was an amateur photographer, so I was around his camera, and every once in a while he let me take family pictures. And I grew up in suburbia, white suburbia. But my dad and my grandfather worked in Spanish Harlem in New York City. My grandfather owned a furniture store, and so I would go from this suburban environment into Harlem, which was, as you can imagine, the sounds, the smells, the sights, and the poverty was so different than where I was growing up. And it kind of made me realize that there was this whole nother world out there that I guess has really informed my photographic work over the last 45 years. I went off to college in 1969, to Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and immediately immersed myself in both the school newspaper, which was a daily, and also in the anti-war movement. So in that era, you could avoid the draft if you went to college. You received a student deferment. And I began to work with some newly found friends, creating the Athens Peace Committee, and we organized the campus around the war, around racism, poverty, all the issues of that era. I had a camera. I had in high school dabbled in photography, but it didn't really click for me that I could really photograph the world around me in high school, at least, which is kind of sad when I look back. But I began to photograph in 69, and I guess my earliest photographs were during the Vietnam moratorium, in which we sent busloads from our school to march, in which was one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in the history of America in Washington, D.C. I guess that moment I kind of, you know, thought, oh, this is really good. But I was really in two worlds. I was starting to take photography, and I was still actively involved as a campus radical and organizer. Really, for me, the moment of deciding to become a photographer happened on April 29th, 1970. We came out of a long, cold winter. We had been organizing during the winter, doing various, we actually built a shanty town on the college green called Pinkville, based on a massacre that had happened in South Vietnam. And we lived in the cardboard shanties for a couple days to draw attention to the anti-war movement. And so people were organizing. And when the spring came, we saw a large increase of the number of students who became active. And partly it was around voting. We couldn't vote. So if you were 18, I was 18 years old. The legal voting age at that time was 21. And so there was this, you know, absurdity that you could go to war and die in war, but you couldn't, and you could drink beer, but you could not vote in America. We organized rallies and demonstrations, and a big part of this was not only anti-war activity, but the feminist movement was gathering amazing steam in our college town, and the idea that there would be feminist studies, for example, which the administration said, why do girls want to have feminist studies? Mm-hmm. I mean, black studies. I mean, these things today people take for granted, but these are really academic pursuits that came out of this era of students fighting for their voices to be heard and to open up the university to people other than white males, which is what it had been historically. We organized, and this was happening all over America on many college campuses. And in late August, Ohio State University, which was about 45 minutes north of where I was going to school, they had the similar issues, and the administration just didn't know. We're not, no black studies, no women's studies, no go back to class. No, we don't, you know, ROTC staying here. Campus recruiters can come. And the students there erupted in what ended up becoming a massive riot. The governor at the time, James Rhodes, called out the National Guard to be on campus the next day to put down in case there were demonstrations, in case they continued. I hitchhiked up to Columbus with my 35 millimeter camera and five or six rolls of film and a gas mask, which I had with me. And when I arrived on their campus in Columbus, which was also the capital of Ohio, there were the National Guard deployed on the college green, and hundreds of students, enraged, not only enraged about the issues that they've been fighting for, but now enraged that your campus is occupied by soldiers, National Guard soldiers with helmets and guns and fixed bayonets. And all of a sudden they start throwing tear gas at the students to try to break them up. And this was a very radicalizing moment for their campus in particular, because the photographs I made that day show students with their books in their arms, you know, and you can only imagine the experience of walking out of classroom and being apolitical. And all of a sudden, you know, there's a tear gas canister right in front of you. And so I began to photograph. And after about an hour of photographing, of which kind of are the centerpiece of my new book, I was actually arrested by the highway patrol, which grabbed me from behind and handcuffed me and took me to a paddy wagon. And I said, I'm a journalist. I have a press pass, which was on my jacket. They grabbed the press pass. They ripped it up into pieces and threw it up in the air and said, not anymore. And I went to jail with about 300 other demonstrators that day. When I got out the next day, I actually was given back my gas mask, a paper bag, which had my camera and my film. I hitchhiked back to Athens, developed the film, made prints, 8x10 prints, and sent them to Liberation News Service in New York City. Liberation News Service was at that time the Associated Press of underground newspapers. So in 1970, there were about 650 underground newspapers throughout America in almost every large city and many small cities and college campuses. They published those photographs just at the moment that Kent State happened. So 5 or 6 days after my arrest and making these photographs, the same National Guard was sent to Kent, which had similar rioting, and that's where the four students were shot by the National Guard. My photographs of the Guard and that day in Columbus were published all over the world. I mean, Africa, Europe, Cuba, Latin America, and of course, throughout the U.S. and underground newspapers. And it was like, you know, I'm 19 years old. You just look at that and you realize, wow, I have a voice. I can witness my world, which was not really being witnessed. If you look at the mainstream media of that era, they were calling us dirty hippies, long-haired radicals. You know, they weren't covering our music. They weren't covering our politics, our culture. And I realized that photography was an incredibly powerful voice to witness the things around you that you felt needed to be seen, the things around you that needed to be changed. And that was the pivotal moment for me where I decided I was going to try to be a photographer.
Hmm. So a question that I have in listening to all of that is at that time you thought of yourself as a journalist or photojournalist, but now you're calling yourself, as I read on your bio, you were calling yourself a documentary photographer. And
yes.
How do you differentiate between those two kind of titles or descriptions?
Yeah. So I think my early work was based on more event oriented. So I would go to this event or that event, and I was really too young and not knowledgeable about the history of photography to understand that one could be a very big storyteller. So I think the difference to me is a documentary photographer would be a photographer who really spends months or years working on a specific idea or a specific project and dives into that in a very deep way and not just skims the surface. I think that photojournalism tends to be something that is assigned to you. Go to this event, go to that event. It can be you're there for 2 hours, you make an illustration, and photojournalists are incredibly talented. Newspaper photographers, very, very, very talented. I mean, they're able to go to an event for 2 hours or 3 hours and to pull out a moment. But there's no long-term thread to what they're doing. There's no long-term storyline. Each story is a very short moment. So for documentary photographers, the storyline is and the theme is incredibly, incredibly important. And so that's really where I moved. Shortly after I made these photographs in 1970, I began to dive into doing longer stories. I photographed a shoe factory in Athens for almost a year. I did a project on high school students, going to many different high schools, photographing, and then many other projects over my career have evolved that way.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about your book, What's Going On, 1974, and this is your ninth book. Is that correct?
It's my ninth book. Yes,
your ninth book. So how did this book come about, and why do you think it's published this year, 2016? Why do you think 2016 is the right time to tell these stories?
So I've been looking at this work for many years. I mean, the wonderful thing about the old technology film is it's a very stable platform. Mm-hmm. And so, you have contact sheets, you have the negatives. I was very careful at keeping those organized in file cabinets. And as I moved from place to place, they always traveled with me. And I had prints that I had made over the years, and I kept going back to look at the work, and it kept growing and growing. I've been trying to do this book probably, I want to say, for maybe five or six years. As I was doing these other projects, it always would kind of rise to the surface, and I would say, oh, I should really do this book. In fact, I reached out to a number of different traditional publishers, and they would say, we love these pictures, but we hate Nixon. Or they would say, yes, these pictures are great, but we've seen them before. I mean, there would always be some sort of excuse. There would be love thrown at me, and then there would be some sort of rejection. And finally, I decided this work was important to be seen. This era was important to be seen. And I think part of it came out of, you know, Occupy and witnessing the Occupy movement. And then also, of course, witnessing what's happening now with Ferguson and the National Guard being called out and Black Lives Matter. And now we have in San Francisco, young people going on hunger strike, the Frisco Five, that it really is kind of a mirror image of what we did in the 60s of young people wanting to see change faster than it was happening, of demonstrating, of going into the street, of trying to have a voice. One of the great things of the new technologies is Kickstarter. And so I decided, I did 8 other books. I've been on press for all my books. I've worked with all my publishers. I've sequenced the pictures. I've gone out and gotten writers to write for the books. So I'm pretty well schooled in how you do a book. But there was something special about this book that was really deep within my spirit, that not that my other books aren't, but I really wanted to have complete control over the process. I didn't want a editor saying, no, it's too many pictures, or no, here's the cover. And this often would happen when they show you a cover and you say, well, I don't quite like the type. And they go, no, we can't change it. We have to go. We have a deadline. That's it. This is what we're doing. I didn't want to have that experience. And with the new technologies, you have Kickstarter and the ability to kind of crowdsource and go out into your community, your own community, but also reach out into other communities and try to raise the money to do it yourself. And so I decided I would do this, even though it takes a huge amount of work. And I was photographing another project. I'm busy teaching and doing all those things. It felt so important, and that's what I did. A year ago, April, I put together a Kickstarter campaign. I hoped to raise $30,000 in 30 days. I raised $45,000 in 30 days, and that allowed me to really create a book that was my voice, my story. And the end of the book has a mini memoir with many of the pieces of ephemera that I saved over the years, my press pass, wanted poster of Mark Rudd, political buttons, images that were important to that era. And it allowed me to create the book as I wanted it to be.
That's great. What a heartening response to get so much positive feedback from people to support your project. That's really incredible.
It was very, very satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the book and a little bit about the way you structured the book. The book starts out you start out with a brief introduction which you title 1969. And it gives us an overview of that time. And then you move into the pictures. How do you organize the pictures in the book?
Well, this was a real structural question. And it's really organized in two levels. Because I was young, because I started this when I was 18 years old, I didn't have any sense of how you tell a story. I mean, that even there was a story. I was photographing my world. I was photographing events that I was curious to go to, that, like, what are Nixon people like? I'm going to go to a Nixon rally, or when the POWs came home, or in 72, I got credentialed to the Republican convention, and then I got credentialed to the inauguration and various different, the May Day demonstrations in Washington. So there was a kind of timeline of events, obviously, over 4 years that I did this work, but it was all by accident. And so I wanted to kind of build the book in a way that you would start off by getting a sense of what America might have, what America looked like during this time, but then punctuate America with these political events that were happening, keeping to their timeline. And so the singular images of America, which I had many, weren't always, in terms of when I shot them, weren't always, 1969, I probably was mainly shooting political activity and wasn't yet going out into America to photograph. That happened a little bit later. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of organized it with the political events being on a timeline and the pictures of America just being interspersed to show what that era was like and not date specific. And then we included at the end of the book a timeline so people could see, what happened when Shirley Chisholm decided to run for president, or when the big March for Equality for Women's Liberation happened in New York City, and so forth. So there is a very specific timeline that, you know, shows when the Watergate break-in happened, etc. So the pictures are based on both time, but also on how they flow. And so, you know, the opening picture is the beach in 1969, and then it moves from there to, you know, high school students and a tent revival, and then the first picture of kind of the change that's happening is a photograph of a young kid in Athens, Ohio, with long hair draped with an American flag. And then you begin to see kind of this cultural shift happening, which builds then to 1970, the National Guard coming out, and then goes down there to the end of the book, which of course, I believe when the era ended, which is 1974, when Nixon resigns because of Watergate. And that's really the last picture of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a clear ending point, a clear punctuation on that time period. And then directly after that, the book moves into some text. So you described the timeline, which I have a couple of questions about in a moment. But then the book moves into some text, and the text is kind of prefigured by your Freedom of Information Act, one of your pages from that file.
That was the fun part. In the 80s, I applied under the Freedom of Information Act for my FBI file.
Thank you.
And so the end papers, the front and back end papers of the book are pages from my FBI file. And then the opening image of the mini memoir is the image of one of the pages, which suggests that the FBI not interview me because I work for the underground press, and it would prove embarrassing to the agency.
I'm just laughing about that right now. I can imagine the moment when that was typed out, how non-amusing that was, but how amusing it seems to us at this point in time.
Yes. No. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the timeline is, I found this really fascinating as someone, I was not around during the time period that the book covers. I was born right at the beginning, I guess, of the 1969 timeframe.
So your parents would love this book, right?
My parents, is that what you said?
Yes.
My parents, they were more on the conservative side. So they probably wouldn't resonate so much with with this book. It's really more for me in my family. However, what I really like about your timeline is that you literally go day by day, in terms of each important events that happened each year. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, you know, I have a fairly good knowledge of, even though I wasn't cognizant at the time that these things were happening, of what happened, in the time period. But this is just so specific and really gives an interesting understanding of how events kind of happened in relation to each other. And I'm wondering if you thought about doing this for if you were considering the audience, your audience, as you were doing this, and maybe why you were so specific about going day by day, year by year in terms of building these events?
Yes. Yeah, so I thought of my audience as, of course, my own generation, who are now, you know, getting gray and old, for them to look back. And of course, we do forget what happened, you know, day to day. But I also was looking for the future generations of like my daughter. My daughter's 21 years old, and her friends, and they just love this book. It's really heartwarming. They just love this book because they've heard stories about this. But if you really look out in the media landscape, it's kind of still hidden. Mm-hmm. You know, we still have not examined this period yet. There's no, I mean, it's fascinating to me. I mean, we're still going to the movies and seeing World War II. Or we're seeing now Iraq, you know, there's been a number of, you know, Hurt Locker and so forth about what's happening in the Middle East and the wars. But this whole period has just somehow been skipped over. And there's so much was happening that I felt that there were many missing pieces that I didn't photograph because I couldn't get there or they happened very quickly. That did in fact inform why young people, you know, created this alternative world, fought back, were in the streets, and to have a timeline that would show some of those events, important events, and some unimportant. I mean, most people probably don't know that the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland caught on fire because of pollution, mm-hmm. or the first Earth Day in 1970, or, you know, 1971, we have All in the Family on TV. I mean, these were all monumental cultural and political events that kind of informed this period. And so I felt that there were many pieces missing from the photographs, and the timeline would kind of inform why we did what we did and what happened. And it was really fun doing because there were, you know, to choose what to include and what not to include, what was, and seeing things that I had completely forgotten, et cetera.
Is that something that's easy to describe? Because I would love to know more about why some things may have been excluded and some things included in the timeline.
Yeah, I mean, it was very personal. Like, I wanted to include, you know, John Lennon and Yoko Ono in a bed-in in Peace in Amsterdam. It was an important, you know, cultural moment. Or, you know, Daniel Ellsberg releasing the Pentagon Papers. I mean, there were things that were very, very important to include that everyone would know about. There were other things that, you know, weren't quite as important, but, you know, do you include, I mean, for example, in 1970, we had both Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin dying at 27 years old. I mean, you know, those were not political events, but they were big cultural events that, you know, informed, you know, my generation and the music of my generation.
Sure, sure. How do you think your photography has changed since this time period when you first started?
Well, when I look back, I say, darn it, why didn't I take more pictures? You know, I would step into something. And of course, you're in it in you know, that moment in your life. And you realize, I mean, I realized it was important because I photographed it, but I didn't photograph it quite the way I might photograph it today in terms of making more pictures. I wish I had photographed the daily things around my life, of what my friends did. And because I was part activist and part photographer, I was an insider. I wasn't an outsider just observing and photographing. So, you know, the gatherings of friends where we'd get together to listen to our record players. And I lived in a communal house. I don't think I made any photographs in the communal house I lived in. Cause that was kind of my life, you know. So I think maybe today I'd photograph more of that. I'd have a bigger sense of what the story might be or the story I was trying to tell. As I said earlier, I had no, I mean, I was just photographing. I didn't, I didn't ever think I would be 65 years old and doing a book. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just making photographs. Now I'm doing a book, you know, and so I have a theme. I pursue an idea. I go out very methodically. I try to figure out how the pictures fit together, what pieces I'm missing, what events I might photograph, how I meet people. It's a very, very, and I photograph a lot more. It's a very, very different process now than it was when I was a young photographer.
And do you take the time to photograph the things around you that you kind of visually and experientially take for granted?
You know, I don't. I'm not. Yeah. Sometimes when I travel, I carry a digital camera with me just to make snapshots of stuff around me. So I guess, you know, I keep saying I'm going to do a book called The Accidental Tourist, you know, where I'm just whenever on vacation, I have a camera and I make a snapshot. But I'm pretty focused on falling into a theme or an idea and delving into it and really spending time, you know, trying to understand the story and trying to tell it visually. So I probably haven't learned my lesson.
I feel like personally as that I'm a photographer too. I didn't photograph for a very long time in my life, those things that were happening around me. And, you know, of course now I completely regret that, but there's just, there is a level of, you know, where you do take things for granted and you make assumptions about, you know, where that line is of what's important to photograph and then what, you know, is not important to photograph. When really, you know, I would love to be able to, as maybe you're kind of describing too, to be more democratic about it, you know, where to have an understanding of that everything has equal value, particularly when you're looking at it from this, you know, from the age of 65, say, you know.
Yes. But, you know, the problem for me is that when I get into the photographer space, I'm very intense and very, very focused. Mm-hmm. And it's bad enough when I go on vacation and bring my camera that my wife says to me, "You're lagging behind," you know, because I'm seeing something really interesting when I'm supposed to really be on vacation with my family.
Right.
That's gotten me into a lot of trouble. In the past.
Right. There's a toll that photography takes on your can take on your relationships in those contexts.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I had a question that was related to that. Oh, about film. You still primarily shoot with film, is that correct?
I do. I still shoot with film. I'm primarily shoot with medium format camera. I'm a Mia 6, so that it's a square image, 6x6. I just like, you know, there's something, that I love about the process. There's something about not, constantly looking at the back of my camera to see if I got the image, which I do when I shoot with a digital camera. I mean, I do like others. I make a number of pictures and look, with the film, you can't see, so you don't know if you got it. And you keep, if you keep working on it and keep playing with it. And I like the mystery of that. I like that when I go into the dark room and develop the film and see and pull out the wet negatives off of the developing can, there's just something special about pulling it out and one that you actually got something, you know, that it came out. And two, just the kind of, excitement of seeing whether you got an image, that works or not. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes there's these wonderful accidents that, are the mystery of photography. You're in the right place at the right time and you do something differently. You move the camera a different way. You experiment, And I don't know that I would do that as much with a digital camera as I do with a film camera. And as I said earlier, the platform is great. I mean, it's stable. I don't have to worry about, you know, a new operating system coming in, and all of a sudden I can't do the same thing with my photographs. So, but, you know, I have feet, and you have to have feet in both worlds. So, I mean, I have, it's twice as much work, which is crazy, you know, developing and then making silver prints from the negatives and then scanning the silver prints and scanning the negatives and making digital files, because that's what everyone wants now. It's twice as much work, but yeah, I just love film, and it is fun being like the only one there with film. Now people like, is that film? They just look. Yes, it's film. There's something really wonderful about that.
Do you think the way you describe your process in shooting with your film camera, it sounds as if the way that you approach it and the challenges of not being able to see, I mean, challenges is, of course, a subjective way of describing it, but the challenges of not being able to see the images, it actually makes you a better photographer because you're trying more. You're working harder in that moment.
I think so. I'm sure there'd be lots of photographers who shoot digitally would disagree with me, but I think so. I think that you're always, you never know what's going to happen. There's always technical issues. You know, I mean, I use a handheld light meter to read the light. There's always the mystery. And yeah, I'm constantly working very, very hard and really thinking about, you know, how do I show this moment? How do I see it in a different way? What can I do that I haven't done before? And I don't know if I looked down and saw it and said, oh, I got it, that would be the end of it. And because I can't do that, I think keep pushing to, you know, try to find that moment. And sometimes, you know, I get it on the first shot, and sometimes that moment is, you know, seven or eight frames or two rolls away. And I just keep pushing.
That's great. That's great. So, do you use a classic handheld light meter, or do you use an app on your phone that does the light meter app?
No, I use a classic Pentax spot meter that has to be 35 years old.
Wow. Wow.
I wear it on my neck, you know, the old fashioned way.
Right. That's impressive in every way. Congratulations.
I'm very fast at it. I'm probably faster at doing that than, you know, using the digital camera. And I actually trust it more because I, you know, from decades of using it, I just feel, you know, I know what I'm, it's in my head. I know what I'm doing.
Right.
Rather than, you know, letting the computer and the camera decide what's in, you know, what you should be doing.
Right. Right. And do you prefer the quality of the film image? This is, I'm sure, a question that people must ask you a lot. Do you prefer the quality of that, say, over digital images at this moment?
I do. I mean, I'm shooting black and white, so I do. And, you know, people often say to me, oh, we shoot digital and we, you know, desaturate the color and to make it black and white. It just doesn't have the feel of film. And it's like, yeah, well, it's not. And I guess there's apps now that you can kind of get the film look, right? Mm-hmm. The Tri-X film look. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing like the original. And I also find looking at the photographs as I put together a project, for me, are still easier looking at the analog contact sheets than looking, you know, using Lightroom or Photo Mechanic on the computer to kind of to edit. And I find that I can go through the contact sheets and maybe see something that I don't immediately kind of flag is something that I think should be included in the project I'm working on. And literally 2 days later, that image will pop up in my head, or in the middle of the night, I'll see that image and I'll go back and there it is. So that the process of editing feels much better to me in film than it does on the computer.
Hmm. That's very, very interesting. Very interesting. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time here, but before we say goodbye, I was wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now.
Sure. For the last almost 5 years, I've been looking at America. So it's a very broad project. I was about 4 years ago, I was visiting professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, And I spent the whole semester photographing in New York, and then I went to Detroit, and I traveled all over the U.S. And I'm really looking at, it's about income inequality. It's about kind of, it's almost like an annual report of how I see America at this moment and what's happening and kind of the demise of America internally. So it's a very big subject. I'm really, really excited about the work. It's huge right now. I'm editing and sequencing it, and I think I have almost 170 photographs, which is kind of crazy. And I'm struggling right now with the ending. The ending is very dark, which I kind of feel but don't think works yet in the book. So I'm pretty much finished shooting, although my last two pieces, I went to a Bernie Sanders rally in Stockton last week, and I got a picture I really like from that. And then I've been credentialed to photograph the Republican convention in Cleveland in July. And I'm hoping I'm going to get some images from that that might fit into the ending of this story.
Wow. Lucky you. Yeah. That would be spectacular. We'll be in a spectacular event on many levels.
Yeah, it should be very exciting. Sure.
How do you see text working in this in your latest project?
You know, I haven't figured that part out. I think it needs some text, but I don't know if it needs a lot of text. I mean, I've kind of sometimes text just, as my wife says, people never read the text, and she says that because she wrote for my last two books, and people see it as a photo book. So I haven't gotten to that point where if I'm just going to have someone write a short introduction, that sets the stage and let the pictures tell the story, or have more text talking about income inequality and what's happened. But I think people know that pretty much, people live it. So I haven't gotten to that point yet.
Hmm. Well, I mean, you're creating a document for the future as well,
yes,
where
absolutely.
The landscape will be very, very different from the one that we're currently living in. So,
yes.
So I hope there is a little something that contextualizes for those people.
Yeah, no, I think that is definitely important. I just haven't figured out what that is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. Would you mind telling our listeners where they can find your book?
Sure. There's a number of places, but directly from me, a signed copy, you can go to my website, kenlight.com, and you'll see the cover of the book, What's Going On. You can't miss it. It's an American flag. You can click on that, and that will take you to squareup.com. And the URL for Square Up is squareup.com/market/kenlight-photo. So either one of those will take you. Obviously, you can go to Amazon. It's the same price. It's unsigned. And if you go to Square Up or to my website, I actually get all the money myself rather than a small slice that Amazon gives you.
Great. So we'll include a link to Square Up. So,
yes.
So listeners can find that directly through our post. And the name of Ken's book, Ken Light's book again, is What's Going On, 1969 to 1974. Thank you so much for your time. It was really wonderful to talk with you and hear all about your book.
Thank you.
Good luck with your next project, which sounds really, really exciting. I can't wait to see it and see
on my Kickstarter list, if I do Kickstarter.
Thank you. I'll be there first in line.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.